This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Science with Dr. Carl. This is a Triple J podcast, and very soon we're going to be going on tour for our 50th birthday. We've got 5 gigs around the country in Hobart, Newcastle, Adelaide, the Gold Coast, and Torquay. Tickets are still available, and we've got different lineups at each location. Now, this week on the Science Hour, it was all about Hobart. We got friend of the show and evolution expert Zoe Keane on the show this week. She answered questions about Tasmania. We talked about Neil the Seal, the Tasmanian Tiger, the Bass Strait, and all of your evolution questions. And the best one, when I double pass to the Hobart leg of the Triple J 50 on tour. That is all coming up. My name is Lucy Smith. Let's get into it. I've got Dr. Carl opposite me. And Dr. Carl, we've got a special guest in the studio.
We've got the fabulous Dr. Zoe Keane. Welcome, Dr. Zoe.
G'day, g'day.
Now, Zoe, you are a friend of the show. You join us sometimes from Tassie. We've got you in the studio. And I feel like this is a very poignant week for you to be joining us because I don't know if you've heard, but we are heading to Hobart for our Triple J 50th, putting on a big old gig there. You've got your tickets.
Oh, mate, I heard the moment they were announced, and as soon as I could get tickets, I got tickets. Like, you know, when you, I was worried they were going to sell out, so I got them the instant they came out. Within the minute, I had an alarm set on my phone.
We love people like you, Zoe, honestly. And you love Emily Waramara, right? One of the artists that you're really drawn to.
Absolutely. So she's spent a lot of time in Tassie, based in Tassie, and I saw the most beautiful gig of hers maybe about a year ago when just before she launched her album, and it was in this incredible record shop called Suffragette Records that sells records by women and non-binary artists, and it's in Nipaluna, Hobart, and it's just the most beautiful little intimate shop, and friends and fans of hers just stacked into this tiny place. We're all kind of cross-legged on the floor, holding each other as she just gave the most beautiful set. It was mainly just Emily by herself, but then she had friends that came up and sung songs with her as the afternoon light poured in, and it was actually one of the most magical gigs I've been to in a while. And
so good.
Yeah, she's an incredible, and her video clips are amazing. So I'm excited to see her and excited to see everyone else as well.
Yeah, Courtney Barnett, Gordon's grandson, Luke and Brasi reforming. So, Zoe, you're already heading along. You've got your tickets. But right now I am waving a double pass in front of someone. I want you to send in your question on 0439757555. If you're in Hobart, you can head along to the gig on November 15. A double pass could be yours. We are looking for one of the best science questions this episode. So whether you are in Hobart, you can head along. Make sure you put hashtag tickets with your question. Now let's start with a Tasmanian icon, Becca in the Hunter Valley. Kick us off.
Hey, Neil Seal. What's his deal?
Becca, that's bars, Becca. Neil Seal, what's his deal? What's your question? What do you specifically want to know?
Well, it's a bit random, don't you think, that there's a seal kind of just wandering through the streets and, you know, lobbing up on people's doorsteps and, you know, rounding up police and all the stories that I've seen.
All right.
Yeah.
Dr. Carl, have you heard of Neil the Seal?
I know nothing.
Okay. Why don't you, Zoe, give us a little bit of an introduction to who Neil the Seal is and then, why he's acting like this.
Yeah, Dr. Carl, I've got some videos to show you in the next song break. So Neil the Seal is a Tasmanian icon. He is an elephant seal, but he's a teenager. And so these are seals that get absolutely massive. And you might have seen in nature documentaries videos of them lumbering across the, a beach. They'll be essentially lumbering across a beach with a big colony of seals and two males that are absolutely massive. They have huge sexual dimorphism, these seals. So
that means sexual dimorphism.
Yeah. That means that males and females are really different from each other. So humans have a small amount of sexual dimorphism. We're a little bit different from each other, but there's a lot of overlap. Whereas male elephant seals are absolutely massive. So, you know, peacocks, for instance, have sexual dimorphism where a peacock is absolutely fabulous and a peahen is beautiful but subdued. So that's sexual dimorphism. Mm. And the males fight each other in this absolutely vicious way. So they'll get on the beach and they'll just charge at each other and absolutely wreck each other's faces. And Neil's young. He's not as big as these adults get. But he's got to be in training, right? So if you're going to be the very best, like a boxer, right, you have got to train and train and train. And so this teenage seal is doing battle against traffic cones and essentially he'll lob himself up onto, you know, someone's driveway and start to attack their post box or something like that. But I have some tea on Neil the Seal because it's very weird that Neil is coming to Lutruwita, Tasmania. Usually they spend their time, they'll travel a long way to eat food, but they spend their time in the Southern Ocean and they haul up on islands on the southern ocean, like Macquarie Island. So this is in between Antarctica and mainland Australia, right? But Neil was born in Tasmania. So his mum didn't make it back home. It's the equivalent of, say, if you're living in a rural area and you don't quite get to the hospital in time and you have your kid on the side of the road.
Wow.
Right? So he was born actually where he's kind of currently being a terror, and he's got this site fidelity to that spot. So if you're ever wondering, well, why is this elephant seal coming back to the same place over and over and over again? That's because his start in life was a little different, a little weird. And
oh, my God, and that's his home.
Yeah. And that's his home, yeah.
And you mentioned the two words I've never heard before. Have you ever heard these before together? Site fidelity.
No, what's that?
Neither have I. Yeah. Please explain.
So site fidelity is when you, you could talk about it as just people or you could talk about it as a species, return to the same spot. So lots of species will, you know, they might like move and go to lots of different places, but they will return to the same spot. So albatross do this, for instance. They go to the same place to nest over and over again.
And then I ran into some elephant seals on Macquarie Island.
Yes.
When on one of my trips to Antarctica. And I said, how dangerous are they? And the guide said, have a look along the beach. And the beach was a couple of kilometres long. And there were penguins all along the beach for a couple of kilometres. And they... Do you see that boundary, he said, around the elephant seals where there's only sand? And I said, yes. He said, that sand is, on average, the length of an elephant seal. An elephant seal can whip around in its own body length really quickly, and they weigh a couple of tons, and they can just kill you with their weight. So stay at least one body length away from an elephant seal.
Neil the seal isn't as agile, maybe though.
No, he's a young buck. He might not seem agile when he's like going a traffic cone.
Flopping along, yeah.
But they can move incredibly quickly, so you do have to give him some space. But I have a story about an elephant seal. If we've got a moment, I went to school in Williamstown in Victoria before I moved to Tasmania 15 years ago, and my school was right by the beach. And after school one day, I went down to the beach and there was a young male elephant seal who was there. And he wasn't like Neil the seal who was coming back to the same place over and over again. But often these young blokes, they'll travel and go really far. And he was just hauling up to have a break. And I got really excited and I ran all the way back to the staff room. And it was after school swimming day. So I was wearing these kind of like parachute pants, really loose, tied up pants situations that were gold in my like school colour. And I ran all the way to the staff room. It was after school and the two like coolest teachers in the school were having a beer together. And I ran in and I was like, there's an elephant seal on the beach. Just ran in, just didn't announce myself. And then my pants fell down. So it was the first time I saw an elephant seal.
Great. Becca also wanting to know, is there a movie going to be made about Neil the seal? Do we know about this?
There should be.
Yeah. We'll have to see.
I'd watch it.
Hey, Olivia, you're in Nipaluna, Hobart. You've got a question about the auroras. What do you want to know?
Yeah, I do. So I'm lucky to look directly towards Antarctica from our house, so we often see some beautiful auroras. But I wanted to know why they're such different colours at different times. So sometimes they're really vibrant green and then other times they're more red and orange. So I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, great question, Dr. Laura. I also have got to see them. I think, Dr. Carl, have you got to see them as well?
Yes, the word nitrogen has the letter R in it. And therefore, on average, the red colour is caused by nitrogen. And therefore, by exclusion, any other colours, oxygen give you the blue and the green. It's more complicated than that, but that's related to it. Also related to it, what altitude they above the ground, 90 kilometres, 200 kilometres, they interact with what thin atmosphere there is.
Yeah. So if you're getting something like a green, that's being produced by oxygen. But what is happening is the oxygen is getting excited. So the sun is super overexcited, especially at this time of year. Not this time of year, sorry, this time of the solar cycle. We're on this like several year solar cycle. So this is why last year it was such a good aurora season. And then the year before that was pretty good. This year was pretty good. And when the sun's sending out all this stuff, that's what's hitting oxygen and nitrogen, and the nitrogen is getting super excited. And different heights. I thought that nitrogen, I didn't know that nitrogen was causing red. I thought that caused another colour.
It could be. My knowledge is old and running off memory, which is not to be trusted, so therefore I should put in a disclaimer. I could be wrong. Please let me know so we get it right for the future.
Yeah, I think that nitrogen might not be red, but we'll have to fact check that.
I saw the Aurora Australis in New Zealand, Olivia, and it was just beautiful. So you've seen it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We see it pretty often, but yeah, last year was incredible, as Zoe said.
You can only see it through your phone screen. Did you have the same thing?
No, last year very much to the naked eye.
Oh,
it was all across the sky, dancing colours. It was absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, when I was in Queenstown, to the naked eye, it just looked maybe like, you know, when you have a football game or a concert that's on and you can see the spotlight going through the sky. It was almost like that, and then you would get your phone up with the long exposure and then you could see it all just moving. It was incredible, Olivia. So I hope that clears it up a little bit for you.
And awesome. Tasmania is one so
of
much.
The, and Tasmania is one of the unsung places in the whole world to see auroras because it's easy to get to.
We've got Laura in Launceston now. Laura, you've got a question about the Tasmanian tiger. What do you want to know?
Yeah. Hi, doctors. I would like to know, why does the Tassie tiger look like a dog, but it's actually a marsupial, and how did it evolve to, a predator role similar to wolves despite being a marsupial?
Great question, and very exciting for me because I love talking about evolution, and this is a really fundamental idea in evolutionary biology. Essentially, the idea is called convergent evolution, and this is the idea that, you know, if you're evolving to fill a similar kind of role in your ecosystem, you might evolve similar shapes. So, for instance, a dolphin and a shark are not very related to each other at all, so, so distant. But they're both these torpedo-shaped creatures that they're sharp at the front, and then they have fins in similar places for stability. And that is a really great shape to have if you want to be an open ocean predator. Whereas with the thylacines, they've evolved in their own specific context, and that context is Australia. They actually used to be all over mainland Australia, and there were lots of different species. They were actually tiny mini little thylacines, and there were bigger thylacines. And so this shape is something that clearly works really well for being a predator. So having, you know, your four paws on the ground, having this pointed muzzle, your eyes facing forward. A lot of predators have their eyes facing forward. They have really better depth perception, whereas a lot of herbivores will have eyes more on the side so they can see the, potentially the thylacines coming at them. So they would have evolved really slowly over time, and changes would have happened in their lineage to make them more that way, just in the same way that it happened with wolves.
Yeah, wow, that's super interesting. And Josh, one of the producers that rang, mentioned as well that it's one of the only extinct marsupials where the male also had a pouch, which I thought was really interesting as well.
Yeah, and he's right on. And the reason that they probably evolved this pouch was to protect their junk as they were running through the forest. So imagine if think of a dog with its dangly bits.
Yeah.
If your pouch can cover those, that's great. But the other marsupial that has males with a pouch is actually a semi-aquatic one in South America. South America has a whole lot of marsupials, and they do a lot of swimming. And so, you know, it's kind of like the world, like it's like being having a built-in budgie smuggler, essentially. They're able to keep it all tight when they're swimming around.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Laura, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh, my God. Even producer Josh has the knowledge. Love this. And we got a question earlier about the Aurora Australis, and we're talking about the different colours and what they are in the sky. Now, we have a bit of a fact check, a bit of a correction. What are we kind of getting confused on here?
What I said was, the letter R appears in both red and nitrogen. Therefore, from memory, nitrogen gives off the red colour. But Zoe went and did some fact checking.
I just had a feeling in my waters that that wasn't the full story. And so while nitrogen can sometimes give off a red light, it's actually usually oxygen that gives off that red light. So oxygen will, when it's hit, it can give off that green light, and it gets very excited, and a little electron does a little jump and it emits green light. But then the next thing to happen, because it's still a very exciting situation, it's still getting blasted by the sun, another electron atom can pop and make a little jump. It's a forbidden transition, that's the scientific term. and then that gives off the red light. But you usually only see the red light at higher altitudes. So often when you're looking at an aurora, you'll see that there are different colours in different places in the sky. And so you're seeing that up in the higher altitudes. And that really incredible aurora we had last year, the first kind of sight I saw of it out of my window, and it was so bright you actually didn't need a phone to see it,
wow,
was this glowing red. And I thought that someone had lit a flare off.
Wow. Was it bright enough to throw a shadow? I've seen photos, I've seen auroras, I have never seen a shadow behind me, I want to see one. But getting back to my mistake, number one, I was wrong. Number two, this is good because it shows that science is self-correcting. And number three, the lesson is that for every question in physics, there is an answer that is simple, clear, easy to understand, intuitively correct, and unfortunately 100% wrong. And that was me.
But you weren't 100% wrong.
Maybe
you
90% were... wrong.
You were a little wrong.
I was wrong. Yeah. When you're wrong, you're wrong. Science wins, I lose. Science is self-correcting. Science is the way to not get fooled.
In the words of Hannah Montana, everybody makes mistakes.
Love my hand, Tom. Wow, what a goddess Hannah was.
Hey, Tom, in Kwana country, Canberra, you've got a question about farts, of course. What do you want to know?
I do. I'd like to know, can you sniff a fart away or are you better off holding your breath?
So talk us through this. So let's say you've done the fart in question and then you sniff it. Are you saying that you are getting rid of the evidence up your nose?
Yeah, basically. Can you sniff, if I and someone else are in a room together and I fart, can I sniff away all the bad smell before they get it?
It's like a self-vacuum.
Almost vacuum it away.
Almost certainly not, because you can breathe in about 5 litres of air per minute. The fart gas smells spreads rapidly through the room, the bad smells, and would probably cover in 20 litres in a very short period of time. 20 litres is like the volume of a human's chest, right? And so you couldn't sniff it all in. It's not impossible. You could do it. And the reason you don't notice your own farts as being bad is because of habituation. And there was somebody called La Petermaine in France in the 1800s who made an entire stage career of being able to speak to me chocolate lips, able to say words through farts, and even as well as lighting fart gas. Don't do lighting fart gas. You can get burns.
Okay, I'll stick to just sniffing then.
Yep, you've got to sit in the evidence, Tom. No. Hey, we've got Sharon in Melbourne. Sharon, you want to know about a particular feeling. Talk us through it.
Yes, hi, doctors. I want to talk about the goosebumps and chills that you get when you listen to really amazing music or experience really incredible art, like a great singer like Fonzie, for example. So I'd like to know two things. What is like physiologically happening in our body or like with the body and the brain? And the second part of my question is there an evolutionary reason why we get goosebumps when we have that kind of artistic pleasure?
Oh, okay. Quickly, I think there is a term for it, and that is aesthetic chills. So when you hear something really beautiful, say you're at the Triple J 50th and you hear a beautiful song.
Okay, the plug. I love
aesthetic,
that.
Aesthetic chills.
Yeah, there is another term for it as well called frisson, which is essentially that feeling you get when maybe, you are watching a movie or a TV show, but particularly to do with sound, and it just creates this kind of wave over your body.
Oh, that's incredible.
You know, like Sharon has said, those physical symptoms, right? Hair standing on end, goosebumps. Well, what's that about?
I wonder if Dr. Carl could talk to the physical symptoms of what's happening in the body, but I have a hypothesis around the evolutionary origin of it, and that is a lot of animals, when they are exposed to a threat, you freak them out, their hair rises up, and this is to make them look bigger and more threatening. So if you're ever walking your dog and your dog gets a bit freaked out, you often see that their hackles raise. That's an example of this. So I wonder if one of the things is just when our nervous systems are getting overwhelmed in this way, it's this ancient response. Hypothesis, I'm not saying that's the answer.
And following on from you, cool, you're dead right, in the sense that in the same way that many different diseases will have the same symptoms. I've got a runny nose and I'm in bed and I'm having fevers, many different diseases in the same way that. So too many things that happen to you from the world environment have the same response of accidentally activating your sympathetic nervous system, which is involved with threats. It is not a threat, but it accidentally involves it.
I also think when we listen to music, and it can happen consistently with artists, but I think the most physical goosebump reaction will often come the first time you hear something. Mm. So maybe it also taps into that feeling of being, or that evolutionary thing of being caught off guard. So
I
then you're,
that.
You know, you're kind of on edge, if you will, or at attention.
Yeah.
Do you reckon that's got something to do with it?
Yeah. Look, I'd be testing that in a lab. That sounds spot on to me.
And the certain elements that are involved in music that can give you goosebumps, common elements are dynamic characteristics, where it often can go very loud and very soft, and then you can have sudden unexpected chord changes, modal shifts, rising melodic lines, and sometimes a note, a famous vocal peak that comes in. And you're dead right. When it's unexpected, you get it more. The more you get used to it, the less times you get the goosebumps. Mm,
but Sharon, you were saying Farnsley always does that for you?
Oh, definitely. I think there's something to do with like the certain kind of vibration of certain voices. Mm. So the timbre of certain voices definitely get me. And I saw Katie Noonan do the Grace album on Sunday, and that was like, I was just in chills for like 2 hours. So that was glorious.
Sharon, love that question. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Thanks, doctors. Have a great day.
You too. And we got Gordon in Albury. Now, Gordon, you got a question about, is it bales of hay?
Yes, Lucy, it is.
Yeah, what's your question?
My question is a question that I asked my dad when I was younger who didn't have the answer, which is that when round hay bales get baled up with too much moisture in them, they can eventually catch fire internally. How does that happen?
Ah, spontaneous combustion. And just as a disclaimer off onto the side, because I do that all the time, on its fateful voyage across the Atlantic, the Titanic was on fire from the moment it set off. In fact, before it set off. Spontaneous combustion had happened in bunker number 6. It had 6 coal bunkers. Coal's got a huge amount of energy in it. 5 kilograms of coal will power your house for a day. And it had been on fire through, it had a certain amount of moisture and various things had happened, and then it caught on fire. So separately to the fact that it got hit by an iceberg, vice versa, it hit the iceberg, it was on fire. What happens inside a hay bale? It's a 3-stage process. Number 1, bacteria heat the temperature up to about 80 degrees C, and you're thinking, that is very hot. That's almost boiling water. Secondly, chemical reactions like the one that burned the coal in the Titanic take it to the next stage, 150 to 200 degrees C. 200 is way above 100 degrees C, which is boiling water, and then the flames take off. And so a kilogram of compost can generate more than 6 watts of heat, which is roughly, kilogram for kilogram, 30,000 times more than the sun generates. The sun is very lazy and generates 30,000 times less heat per kilogram than your compost pile. Might switch off my phone. Whereas, on the other hand, your compost pile is very small, so it only generates it locally. Running through the 3 stages. In the first stage, it depends upon the level of moisture in the hay bale, according to a story I wrote back in 2015. If it's less than 20% moisture, the bacteria will die. If it's over 50%, the bacteria will be fine and the heat they go just evaporates the water. But if it's between 20 to 50%, the temperature will rise and rise and rise, and then you can go to the second stage where you get chemical reactions happening. And they depend on the fact that you're burning carbon with the oxygen, enough oxygen around it, with enough air available to give the temperature up to 200 degrees C.
Zoe?
I was just listening to you talk about the bacteria giving off heat, and I was thinking, oh, it's probably good to explain why that's happening. And that is a kind of symptom of their metabolic processes. So all of the chemical reactions that are happening in their tiny little cells at one time, that is giving off heat, just like we give off heat when we're metabolizing. Yeah, we need to do that to keep ourselves at an even temperature. So that can be happening. And the other thing I wanted to say was you can get this on a far more relaxed scale in your own compost bin, because in a compost bin, when that's working really well and the compost is working, that should warm up. And a good compost is a warm compost.
Mm. It is. And just as a bit of background, Zoe and I have a secret love affair about mitochondria, which make the heat. Look up mitochondria, you'll love them.
Does that help, Gordon?
No, that makes sense. I was assuming it was bacteria. I wasn't too sure if it came to a point where the bacteria heated up the middle and then it was sort of, you know, being a ring, might have got closer to the outside with a bit more oxygen and some drier, I suppose, hay that then would catch the light. But no, that makes sense. It goes from, yeah, your compost to chemical to light it up.
Courtney Barnett is playing our Triple J 50th party in Hobart. We're going to five locations around the country, different lineups at each one. And in Hobart, you could also catch Emily Waramurra, Luca Brasi. Zoe Keane is with us. She's from Tassie, and you are heading along to that gig, Zoe.
I absolutely am. I got tickets the moment they came out.
Yes. If you need a double pass, well, send in a good question this morning if you are in Hobart and you can head along to that gig on November 15. Send in a question and you could be in the running to win. Just put hashtag tickets with your question on 0439 757 555. Now, Megan in Inverloch, I feel like your question has a little something to do with this. What do you want to know?
Hi, doctors. Currently looking at the Bass Strait and would love to know if there would ever be a bridge or maybe a tunnel. Thinking about evolution, is it possible?
Between where, Zoe?
Oh, sorry. Inverloch, Victoria, we'll say Victoria and Tasmania.
Wouldn't that be so good? You know, here I am being like, you can win tickets if you're in Hobart, but imagine there was just a portal, a tunnel.
Imagine if you could just get on the train. Yeah. That would be so good.
Or a train. I didn't even think about a train.
Yeah. I mean, that would be my – I mean, I don't drive. I'm 33 with my L's. So, yeah, I'm getting there. I'm getting there. So I'm like, oh, yeah, I'd get on the train. It would be so expensive. So when I think about these tunnels, the one I think about is the one between – the British Isles and mainland Europe. Mm-hmm. And that is a whole lot smaller, like less distance to cover than between the Bass Strait and...
which is about 200 kilometres at minimum.
Yeah, and where, you know, UK to mainland Europe I think is around 30-something Ks.
People can swim it.
Yeah, people can swim it, whereas the Bass Strait, you'd be working hard to swim it. So it would be really hard. And if you're building a bridge, the Bass Strait has really wild currents and weathers and wave patterns as well. It's a really challenging place to navigate just because it's where, you know, all of these currents are kind of sloshing around the continent and sloshing around Lutruwita, Tasmania, and, you know, bashing together in the middle. So it would be really challenging. Not that it couldn't happen, but there used to be a land bridge that connected them. So in the Ice Age or Ice Ages, you could walk between them.
Wow.
Yeah.
When did that dissipate?
When
sink?
18,000 years ago, it began to dissipate. Mm. At its peak, 25,000 years ago, the ocean levels were 100 metres lower and you could walk from the southern tip of Tasmania to New Guinea on dry land all the way. And up to the top left-hand corner of Australia, there was another 250,000 square kilometres of countryside where we think about 250,000 people lived. And we have various tribal legends, Dreamtime songs describing the influx of people from that area. Getting back to the bridge, the world's longest bridge, 168 kilometres.
Wow.
A Chinese bridge.
So this would be
200.
Extending it massively, and we don't have
that money. Or the traffic. But remember the motto of the American Air Force, the unofficial motto, with enough energy, a pig will fly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, Megan, we'll have to see.
Yeah, maybe we need another ice age. But if you're interested in that land bridge, so what used to be there, a mate of mine worked on this incredible project called, I think it was the Land Bridge Project or something. It's online. If you just Google Land Bridge website, and there's great articles and videos online. And through the Bass Strait, there's incredible Tasmanian Aboriginal culture that's still going on there. People still go up there going for Yula mutton birds every season and stuff. So if you want to learn a bit about that side of things, there's really great resources out there.
Wow, get on it, Megan.
Snake Islands out there.
Yeah, it's a beautiful coast. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Put it in the wish list.
Yeah, absolutely. Rory in Melbourne, tell us what you can do.
Sure. Hey guys. I have a fun, I think, ability to smell when people are sick, and I think it's particularly the flu. And from what I understand about it, I'm smelling volatile organic compounds, but I don't know much about it, and I want to know what is the science.
Rory, does it smell like anything, or is it a completely on its own independent smell?
It's a pretty independent smell. Doesn't smell great. As I'm sure maybe you'd imagine.
I did a TikTok on this, on ABC TikTok, which got a few million views. And it was about a woman who had a really good sense of smell, and she loved this guy and he smelled nice, and she married him and they had babies. And then one day she said, "You smell bad." And he said, "Okay." And he tried different things and he still kept on smelling bad, and they kept on going. And 14 years later, he was diagnosed from the symptoms with Parkinson's disease. They went down a pathway and then end up going to a Parkinson's disease self-help group where all these people come together. And she got out of the car and she could just smell this smell.
Wow.
She could smell Parkinson's disease. She mentioned this to the medical people. They said, "Oh, come on, you're lying." They gave her a test. They gave her 10 people, 5 with Parkinson's disease, 5 without. She got all of them right except for one where she said, "You've got Parkinson's disease," and he hadn't. But a year later, he did. We're now working on finding out what that chemical is and have found it. And now we're trying to find ways to diagnose Parkinson's disease before the symptoms happen. When the symptoms happen, you're 14 years down the line, things are bad. If you can diagnose it early, possibly better treatment.
Has there been anything about people who can smell the flu, like Rory?
Not necessarily, but this is a whole field of knowledge that we need to explore. And maybe Australia could become a world leader in this in terms of diagnostics.
Should Dr. Rory be getting in touch with the research team and saying, "Hey, I've got this skill. Do you want to study me? Do you want to put me to the test?"
And you should, and quote the example of the woman who put herself through the test with regard to smelling Parkinson's disease, and from that we've found the chemical and now are getting machines for it. And there are all these anecdotes of the dogs and the cats and the nurses especially. Some of the nurses are just brilliant, and they can say, "Look, I'm sorry, I think you should come in because to see your mum or your dad, I don't think they'll survive much longer."
Wow.
And what they're saying is, "Look, I can smell it. I've smelled it before. She's going to be dead in 2 days. Get here soon." That's what they're trying to say gently.
Mm. Rory, is that something you'd be interested in?
Absolutely.
Yeah, thanks for your question.
Cool. Hey, no worries.
We got Lockie on the Central Coast. Lockie, what do you want to know?
Hey, how's it going? I just had a question about cryogenically freezing yourself. So, like, you've heard of people do it before, but, like, if I got frozen now, would I be able to wake up in 400 years, like, perfectly preserved, or?
Theoretically, yes, but nobody has ever been successfully unfrozen. The problem relates to the fact that when you have a party over Christmas and you want to get the beer cold in a hurry, you shove it in a freezer, you forget about it, and 2 hours later you hear crack, and you open up the freezer and there is a block of ice in the shape of a bottle of beer, but all the glass is broken. And that's because water expands by 10% as it freezes. In the same way, when you freeze a human, the cells are full of water, the water expands, and each cell is full of beautiful, incredibly ornate and complicated biological machines. They're machines, but biological, including Zoe and our best friend, the mitochondria, and they get destroyed by the expanding ice. It is possible to do it, but you have to kill somebody to do it. So what you do is you have a person who is alive and you say, "We're going to freeze you now," and you start removing the water in their bloodstream in their body and replacing it with glycochemicals that do not freeze. And what that means is that on one hand, you can make them freeze and not, you can drop the temperature down and the water doesn't go solid but it turns into a mush, but you've killed the person. They were alive.
So do you reckon modern medicine will evolve enough to, like, be able to, like, put water back in their body and preserve them?
Well, Zoe and I share another beloved great friend, the water bears. And you can get a water bear, what's their other name?
Tardigrade.
And you can get a tardigrade and you can take it to -271°C. And then bring it back again and it's alive. They do it. We don't have to do anything special to them. And we kind of ish know what they're doing. It's turning, they turn into a mush when they freeze, not into a solid. But 2 degrees above absolute zero.
But if you're a water bear or a tardigrade, you've spent a lot of time evolving in moss. And moss is a really extreme environment because it dries up really quickly. And so you have to be able to survive going completely dry. So they've been through millions of years of this evolutionary predicament. But also there are species that can do this. So frogs can, some species of frogs can freeze over the winter, and what they do is really increase the glucose in their organs. And so they don't fully freeze, but they're in a frozen environment. So we need to be a frog.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, we need to be a frog and then it will work.
Now, we were chatting earlier about how people can potentially sniff sickness. An example of someone who could sniff Parkinson's disease and a particular chemical. Now, Kate and Maitland, you've got a follow-up question. What do you want to know?
I do. Hi, guys. So if we do have this chemical that has been identified, is there a possibility of us being able to train sniffer dogs to detect that chemical in people?
Yes, and that's actually happening. So there are lots of dogs that can detect cancer, Parkinson's disease, and a whole raft of other diseases. And they can also detect things like plants. Like, so if you've got an incredibly endangered plant, you can train a dog to detect it. And I know someone who's doing that with a really rare orchid that just looks like grass. And so you don't want to step on it. And so you send the dog out and the dog will show you where it is in a field of grass because you can't spot it with your eyes.
And just an advice for people coming into Australia, if you've got a choice between bringing in from overseas an apple or a small tactical nuclear weapon, go for the nuclear weapon. You'll get in less trouble with your customs people.
Hey, Kate, stay on the line for this next question. Garrick in Geraldton, what's your question?
Hi, doctors. My question is about dogs and why they don't seem to be ticklish.
Hey, Kate, do you have any dogs that seem to be ticklish when you're training them?
I do. So I actually, funnily enough, have a dog that sniffs out koala scat for sort of ecology reasons. So, my dog is incredibly ticklish.
Really? And how do you know? What are the kind of physical symptoms? Similar to humans?
More just super wriggly, and he does make a little bit of noise every now and again.
Okay.
Wow. So cute. And
Zoe?
Well, rats will laugh when you tickle them, and we couldn't hear that. And when we changed the microphones that we're using, we could hear that they laugh when you tickle them.
Dr. Carl, anything to add?
Yeah, so what happens is that you're doing a whole bunch of neural pathways from various receptors in your skin into the brain, and we've actually mapped them out. And so with dogs, you get three main activities in their tickling. Firstly, there's this quick surprise sort of flinch, and they move away from you. Secondly, they look towards the hand and then move away. And then the third one is they make a weird sort of noise, and they're the three main behaviours the dog do when they're tickled.
There you go. I guess I just don't have ticklish dogs.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Garrick, and thanks, Kate.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, guys.
And that's it for this week's episode of Science with Dr. Carl. Zoe Keane has been with us. Now, Zoe, we're giving away tickets to our upcoming Hobart gig, which you were going to be at, and we wanted very specifically good questions about Tassie, and this is the winning entry of this double pass.
Why does the Tassie tiger look like a dog, but it's actually a marsupial? And how did it evolve to, a predator role similar to wolves despite being a marsupial?
Oh, so Laura and Tassie, you are going to be rubbing shoulders with Zoe Keane on the dance floor with Courtney Barnett, Emily Waramara, Gordon's grandson, and heaps more. If you want tickets, head to the Triple J website. And Zoe, thank you so much for hanging out with us. If people want to learn more about you or what you're working on at the moment, where should they go?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find me on social media, Zoe, Zoe underscore Keane, K-E-A-N underscore Sci, like the start of science. I'm on Insta, TikTok, Threads, Blue Sky, so you can find me there and any events or anything that I might be doing. So check it out.
The lot. Zoe Keane Sci on Instagram and all socials. Dr. Carl, I'll catch you next week.
Peachy Keane.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's episode of Science with Dr. Carl. We'll leave Zoe's details for you in the show notes. You can check out her socials and her latest book, Why Are We Like This? And if you want to head along to our 50th birthday tour, you can do so. Tickets are available right now via the Triple J website for Hobart, Newcastle, Adelaide, Gold Coast and Torquay. It's all kicking off on November 15 and there's different artists at each location. I'm Lucy Smith. This episode was produced by Josh Brennan and we'll catch you next week. Bye.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack podcast, it's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.